Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This is the Book Riot Podcast. It's a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. Today's Thursday, February 23rd, 2023. I'm Jeff O'Neill here with Vanessa Diaz, who's sitting in for Rebecca, who's out on PTO. And we're coming to you from the North Pole, Vanessa.
Yay!
It's a record-breaking snowfall, apparently, at Portland International Airport today. 10.8 inches, the record out there. My daughter was out with a ruler this morning, as nine-year-olds are wont to do, and we've got about 9 inches on our deck. You're pretty close. You're probably about the same.
Yeah, more or less. I haven't actually been outside to check, but based on the number of cars in the parking lot in front of me that have been having a real fun time out of digging out, it looks to be about that much.
And as a native Californian, nay, San Diegoan, you are an expert snow driver. You've told me this several times.
Absolutely.
You're out there. You're ready to go. You're just going to get out.
Shout out to my dentist who laughed at me yesterday when I was like, I'm not coming. And they were like, why? I'm like, have you looked outside and where my zip code is? They're like, no, like I'm not coming in, or my area code. Like, sorry, bro. Yeah, there was no chance.
No.
There's still some novelty. I think it's really pretty. And I absolutely went out and made a snow angel like the first time this happened to me. But I'm now solidly in the place of like, wish I'd gotten more provisions because I'm not going outside.
Yeah, it was a bit of a sneaker. We were expecting some. Anyway, this is all exciting local weather for people out there listening. So we'll keep. But it's nice and cozy in here today. So it's a good day to talk and think about books. And we're going to get into all the news stories of the day. Vanessa, of course, the managing editor of BookRiot.com. Always great to have her on the show. But first, a quick sponsor break, and then we'll get into it a little bit.
Today's episode is brought to you by Amazon Publishing. Let me ask you a question. How well do you think you know people? And how well do you think they know you? Six award-winning, best-selling authors of suspense explore the lingering threat of secrets and the inescapable fear that they can't stay buried forever. So no matter how dark the hiding place, the consequences of revealing the truth can bring out the worst in lovers, friends, family, and strangers. And check this out. You can read and listen to all six short stories in the Never Tell collection free with Prime. You can learn more at amazon.com/nevertell. And these best-selling authors include Liv Constantine, Laurith Ann White, Andrea Bartz, Rachel Halsall Hall, Avi Pachoda, and Carolyn Kepnes. Again, you can read and listen to all six short stories free with Prime and also Kindle Unlimited. So make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Amazon Publishing for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Forever and Kennedy Ryan's heart-searing sensual This Could Be Us. When the life Soledad Barnes built with the man who was supposed to be her forever goes poof in a cloud of betrayal and disillusion, there is no time to pout or sulk or even grieve the life she lost. But then an unlikely man enters the picture. He's the forbidden one, the one she shouldn't want but can't seem to resist. Y'all know how that goes. But Soledad's lost it all before and refuses to repeat her mistakes. She asks herself, can she trust him? Can she trust herself? From the ashes of a life burned to the ground, something bold and new can rise. So This Could Be Us is an instant New York Times and USA Today bestseller. It's been featured on the Today Show and CBS Mornings. And Kennedy Ryan is the first Black romance author to hit the New York Times adult bestseller list in almost 3 years, which is amazing. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to Forever and Kennedy Ryan's heart-searing sensual This Could Be Us for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Harper Perennial, an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers. The author of Love Buzz follows her acclaimed first novel with a delightful Caribbean-set romp about video game designer Sloane Cooper, who has a strategy for everything.
Almost.
Against her better judgment, Sloane says yes to going on a Caribbean vacation with her neighbor. She thinks she can use the time away to develop a game design that will help her get a job offer. But the question is, can Sloane figure out a way to move past heartbreak, land the job of her dreams, all while avoiding catching feelings? She's up against a lot, y'all. In A Not-So-Perfect World by Neely Tubati Alexander, there is this delightful romantic comedy. There's neighbors and lust, a fake dating scheme, and it also explores the all-too-real demands and costs of female ambition, especially for women working in traditionally male arenas. So make sure to pick up the new book. Thanks again to Harper Perennial, an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers, for sponsoring this episode.
Vanessa, we haven't had you on the show in a while, so we're going to get to your some recent reading and anything you've loved recently. But you get to come in and pontificate, sort of paratroop in on some ongoing kerfluffles or
yes.
questions or, ongoing things. And I know you've paid attention to all of them, so maybe a fresh voice will be interesting for everyone, including me today. I guess the big news of the week is that this HarperCollins strike is over.
Yeah.
The contract has been ratified, and I guess we have to believe that everyone is at least satisfied, right? Or else they wouldn't have signed it.
Yeah.
Have you followed this at all? I mean, what you followed it? What's here? What's interesting? What have you thought of this as the thing has gone on?
Yeah, I mean, I've for reasons that of being the managing editor for the site, have definitely been all over it for complicated reasons of trying to figure out how to approach the issue at the time with coverage. Have definitely been very in support of the union, and I also am at the place where I hope that because it has been signed, that everyone is at least satisfied with what they've been able to achieve. Mm-hmm. I'm interested to see what this portends for, future, and then also been reviewing the terms of what they got. I'm like, I hope this is what you wanted, and I don't mean that in a sarcastic way. I feel like it sounds that way.
Right.
But just because some of the stuff in there felt like a little bit incremental, and I hope it makes a really big change for people and that it's a sign of good things, but it's kind of a tangled web, and approaching it on my end has been sort of... towing that line between really wanting to support the union and feeling really terrible for all of the many people from marginalized communities whose books were just not being promoted during that time was a weird piece for me because, it's just the reality. So I'm happy for the employees, for the union, and I hope, again, that this makes a meaningful impact. I guess that's where I'm landing right now.
Yeah. This is what we know specifically so far. I'm going to read from the statement of the local... Chapter 2110 of the United Auto Workers that represents the employees, achieves improved compensation and benefits, including higher minimums, guaranteed annual increases for everyone rated above unsatisfactory, 2 hours of overtime without approval for lowest paid employees, improved union rights with release time during work hours, paid time to participate in joint labor management committee and company's diversity initiatives, improved paid time off and ability to continue to work remotely till July 1st. So, a lot of it is kind of boilerplate's not right, but pretty standard issue union stuff, overtime, pay,
yeah.
Union rights, voting. And one of the big questions and interesting pieces of this that we haven't seen there, because there aren't any other unions in publishing, to my knowledge, at least among the big five, is something about company diversity. The union and the local members of this union, specifically HarperCollins Union, wanting to try to do something, to use the union bargaining power and mechanism to try to build in support, move forward, whatever you want to say, to contribute to increased diversity and inclusion on the publishing house. And I think that's the piece that I was most interested in seeing. Rebecca and I talked about, and you know about this, having been part of our own hiring, that it's not as simple as we want to hire more people of color.
No,
it is and isn't that when it comes to what you could actually hire for, how you can make decisions, you get into some discriminatory stuff. Race is a protected class, and rightly or wrongly, that's a whole other situation. Yeah. But just practically, it works both ways, right? It just does. Yep. Legally, you can get yourself into real trouble, and people have. So what they could actually bargain for on those terms is extremely, extremely interesting to me. And I hope that comes out, because everything else, I'm like, great, you got $1,000 more and there's some other stuff that improves your quality of life, and that's great. But the ability of labor to affect these, I guess, moral issues that transcends, or at least, I don't know, reaches for something other than just very enumerated rights of specific employees, I think is a fascinating moment here. So I assume you're probably pretty interested in that too.
Yeah, I mean, I think you said anything that is ultimately aiming to fundamentally change the fabric of like the way the company operates, right. And it's yeah, how it views that, I guess, their values around diversity inclusion is very interesting to me. I would love to know more, because beyond just the kind of one line that's in here, I literally shared one of our job listings this morning, and you know, the most you can generally say in this situation is that we encourage, and we do, right? Like, that's a huge part of our ethos, so we can speak to our own. But what comes next, and what that meaningfully means for them, I somebody tell me. I absolutely want to know.
Yeah, right. And I think one thing, I don't know if this is true for you, but as we've watched the efforts by fits and starts, two steps forward, one step back, maybe one and a half step forward, one step back of the diversification in publishing over the last, I don't know, 10 years as I've been watching it and being a part of it from the sidelines, a commentariat, I do have more sympathy from how hard it is to move that needle. I still think there's a lot more people could be doing, but from a management point of view, I get it more than I used to. And I don't think that makes me the man or not, but I have sympathy for it. I think it's both takes more longer lasting commitment, but it's not as simple as maybe you would hope it would be. It's just true, unfortunately, or whatever. That's just the case. So I really kind of am more interested in longer lasting incremental, but over a long period, to kind of like your 401k.
Yeah.
You know, you want that compound interest. It might not be a whole lot in 1 year, but let it grow for 10, 15, 20 years. It can really add up. And I think it's just going to take that much time, unfortunately, given so many things, but especially this, the difficulty of making inclusive hiring explicit and goal-based, and you know, really you can't say and behave as if you're trying to do more than hit certain benchmarks that cannot exceed basically the population at large. So it's very tricky, and I'd love to see how they came to something. Is it exciting? Is that the thing that got thrown off because it could?
Yeah.
Is it more, I don't know, is it more forceful than I could have imagined? Maybe they've gotten creative. I'm always hoping someone's cracked the nut of doing this differently, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I'm very curious, just knowing what goes into our own hiring practices. And I mean, we've done the work, or our it's an ongoing thing. It's not that we are finished doing work, but I'm constantly trying to stay on top of how do you account for bias? How do we eliminate it? How do we get, because that's with publishing, the thing I come back to a lot is, A, like you said, it's a giant machine, so any change that you make is going to be a thing that just has to accumulate over time. It's not going to be overnight. And then it's a combination of factors of like, have you undone the stigma around like what publishing salaries are, and like, are you encouraging people of color, are you putting your applications in places where like people of color and folks of other marginalized entities are going to find your application? There's just so much that goes into it, that it's a plan. You have to make a whole plan and strategy, and how this union has been able to affect that is, again, just a thing I'm interested to know more about.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't know that moving the lowest salary from 47 to 48 really gets us much in terms of the difficulty of being an entry-level publishing person in New York. I don't think that matters, Vanessa. I don't think that...
That was the number trick, one thing that screamed at me. And I know that there's a step up, right? That like by 2025, it'll go up to 50.
Five.
But like, based on what I know about New York living... that $3,000.
Well, that's 6% in 2 years. Inflation right now is 4 or 5%.
It's 4 or 5.
So that's going to be a below
inflation. Yep.
It's going to be below inflation. And so I don't know how else to do this. And again, Rebecca and I have talked, we're not privy to their balance sheet.
Nope.
How much money is there floating around?
Correct.
Like, if this went to 75, does that make a difference? I mean, it's certainly a lot more.
Of course.
But does it actively change the, I guess, class background as much as anything for the people coming into entry-level publishing positions? I don't know. So this is good. I mean, if you're working there today, it's better than it was 6 months ago.
which we applaud.
But in terms of this grandiose talk of, let's see here, I'm going to do the quote at the bottom, which I found interesting. I am confident this will lead to a long-lasting change in work culture at HarperCollins and perhaps in publishing at large. Settle down, I think, with $1,000 and no specifics. I guess the proof is in the pudding to me. I'm glad it's over. I'm glad those people get to go back to work. I'm glad all the people who work at HarperCollins that aren't in the union, production staff and everybody else, gets to kind of come back to normal. And especially, and I don't know if especially, alongside the people who don't work at HarperCollins, whether it be, you know, freelancers, illustrators, but especially authors, agents, and, you know, other kinds of people, can get their book out there in a particular kind of way. Because it's a real pity. I mean, these people are going to be, will have been off work for 6 weeks. But if you had a HarperCollins book in the launch window here, that you've been working on for 2 years and waiting for 2 years to come out, that's just...
It's hard.
It's just a bad break. I guess. There's no other way to do it. I mean, you can't blame the union, but it's still a tough break for people with books coming out. So I guess that kind of will put the wraps on that until we hear something else interesting. Or don't. I guess my base case is we don't hear much more about the specifics of the diversity inclusions. Maybe I'm jaded, or maybe I'm experienced. but one of those two things is probably true.
¿Por qué no los dos? But anyway,
that's fair. That's fair. My little Spanish at least knows that much.
I've been waiting to put that somewhere.
I guess that. Yeah, I know, right? It's a very useful term. The story this week that broke out outside, I'd say, the world of books is the decision by the Roald Dahl Escaped to rewrite/remove controversial language from the author's books. You know, the one probably that speaks to people that don't even know who Roald Dahl is or know his books, because the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory movie has been made once. I don't accept the Johnny Depp version. That's some millennial garbage right there. Only the Gene Wilder version for me. And then there's the Timothy Chalamet one coming out as a musical. Gird your loins, internet, for what that's going to look like. But the example given here, and I think the one that's probably indicative and enough to talk about what's happening, is in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Augustus Gloop is described as has been rewritten to be described as enormous rather than fat. And Miss Twits from the Twits is now just beastly rather than ugly and beastly. And this is very interesting. It reminds me of a story we covered, gosh, it might have been 5 or 6 years ago, in which someone... It's different because it's public domain. So, you know, it wasn't the estate, sort of official rewriting of people doing to Mark Twain's Huck
Finn. Oh, that's right.
Or was it Tom Sawyer? Maybe both, of taking out racial epithets and replacing them with different things. For many of the same reasons, I would guess. I mean, it's slightly different manifestations, but similar reasons of there are things that are manifestly unpleasant/racist. Fatphobic, misogynistic, all the kinds of the isms that you have in there, and saying that's not cool and we want to take them out. I have to admit I'm of two minds about this, because there's the scholar's part of me that, like, if it's in the thing, it's in the thing. And if it's that bad, don't read it. There's that part of me that's like that. There's the other part of me that's like, does it really hurt the books that much? Does it hurt Charlie and the Chocolate Factory to make this change? I'm kind of like not. So I'm not really sure, Vanessa. Do you have a strong opinion, or are you bifurcated like me, or where else are you on this spectrum, this particular move?
Shared bifurcation, for sure. Especially, it really depends, too, I guess, on what you're changing. No, it doesn't depend. Let me back up. My feelings, I suppose, can kind of like wish-wash in the sense I'm like, if you put a really racist thing in your book, and there's a piece of me that really rails against the idea that, like, someone's going to fix it, and now, like, not that you get pardoned for it, per se, but, like, again, you put it in there. So, like, you said the scholar part of me is sort of just like, well, you put it in there and, like, let the record stand. There are so many other things that we can read. Like, it's not one of five books left in the world. On the other hand, I get that these are classics. They were classics for me. And I definitely, you know, I guess if you ask me point blankly, do you want a child to be able to enjoy this book without encountering, like, really harmful or hurtful language? Like, of course, the answer to that, I suppose, is yes. I would also argue that the spirit of it is like, okay, so now you call him enormous rather than fat. Like, you're still ultimately probably being fat phobic.
We're good now, Vanessa. We're good, right?
Not
we're
to
cool.
mention,
that's fine. Everyone's fine.
Everything's
with that.
Fine. But like, fat is, especially if you talk to anybody in like the fat positivity community, the word fat is just a descriptor. It's the fact that we have like fat phobically made it a bad thing. But like, fat is a word just like skinny is a word. So like, enormous, I promise you, doesn't change like the actual sentiment with which they're trying to describe Augustus. And in some of the other ones, like, oh, now I'm beastly, but I'm not ugly. Great. Like, I'm not entirely sure where I land on some of this. I don't know. I'm not sure.
And there's a lot of changes, right? It's not just in the witches, it says here, there's a piece in The Guardian I should shout out here by Maryam Zakir Hussain. 59 changes in the witches. That's a lot. That's a lot. And some of them, I don't know. Miss Trumbull, for example, is described as a most formidable woman instead of female. Parents are, references mother and father have been replaced with parents. Oompa Loompas are small people instead of small men. That was a real head scratcher to me. That was a, okay. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, does it ultimately matter either way? Is also, maybe that's the third way. It doesn't matter from a literary historical point of view. Does this help the discourse, so to speak? I guess to be more generous to the Dahl estate would be, we've had our own editorial guidelines change over time as our understanding has changed.
Yeah.
Now, nothing as dramatic as this. I guess it's weird that we think of sort of our editorial guidelines, to put ourselves on the hook a little bit, as malleable, open to change, whereas a book gets printed and that is, it's frozen in time and that's it.
Yeah.
Would I feel different about this if this was Roald Dahl was still alive and he's like, you know what? I'm not happy with this. I think I'd like to go in there. And I think there's part of me that's triggering that. Like, Roald Dahl is not doing this. This is the estate doing this.
Thank you. Yeah.
And so there's a bit of a, it feels like a little bit of bait and switch. Like, the books are what they are. Roald Dahl, also a noted anti-Semite. Let's not mince words.
Exactly.
And probably other things, frankly. That's all that I know specifically about. So I do feel like there could be a bit of, I don't know, woke washing happening here. I'm trying to coin a term to represent a particular author or set of stories as something other than they were. But can you do that and still update them to make them enjoyable for future generations, to feel good about them? Frankly, I'll be honest, I have not recommended the Roald Dahl books to my kids for a lot of these reasons.
Yeah.
Am I more likely today? I don't know, Vanessa. I really don't.
I don't know that I am. I mean, I definitely saw some feedback from, you know, we posted a news post about this that was very much just like, this is what happened. Thanks. Right. Like, it wasn't like, please go read Roald Dahl. It was very much just like the facts of like, this is what we're doing right now, discussing what they're doing. And a lot of people had feelings, which of course I understood. And again, yes, because he was a raging anti-Semite among apparently some other not so great qualities. And so those folks are just like, look, I'm not recommending those books to my kids. And this isn't going to change that. I'm like, oh, now like the witches isn't blatantly anti-Semitic in a million different ways because you've swapped out some words.
Yeah.
And that's the part. And I get that it's difficult. There are so many books, you know, a big franchise in particular, but so many others that, you know, over time now I've come to discover that these authors had some either bad intentions or bad people, bad stuff. I get that if that book means something to you, that you have like an attachment to it. But I'm trying to lean into the place that, again, like, they had their time. Potentially there's just other things that we can point our kids at. And I get why the estate would want to do this, because obviously, they probably aren't sitting from a place of like, and now no one will read this guy's books anymore because he was a bad guy. We apologize. Like,
that's a great point.
They want to keep people reading them. And so they're like, this is, I imagine, one of the only solutions they could come up with. But I don't know that, like, maybe the it doesn't matter tech is where I'm ultimately landing of like, okay, you can, you know, if that's what makes you feel better about it. But ultimately, I'm probably just not going to be recommending the books anymore, even if they did mean a ton to me when I was, you know, a child.
Yeah, that's a good way of thinking about it. I think the motivation here is interesting. Maybe some of it is, you know, broadly altruistic.
Yeah,
but also this is a story. They have copyright to this. They want to move units. They have a publisher, Puffin, who probably someone there is like, you know, we're not going to sell as many books. This isn't great for kids.
Yeah.
Both those things go hand in hand, right? I think the tail can wag the dog there, but also the dog could wag the tail. I guess the part of me is like, extend this to the next wave of, right? I'm not even sure. Like, there's stuff, well, you know, in Mark Twain or in Dickens or in Edgar Allan Poe or things that have become historical documents, literary history.
Correct, yeah.
I don't want those changed. They are what they are. And you don't have to read them if you don't want to. And that they are a document of their time and of that person. And that has value and import and meaning.
It does.
It may not be great. It's not what we want to do today. But I don't know that changing it helps. I don't know that changing it fixes that. And if you need to change it for people to enjoy reading it now, maybe just read other stuff. Because as you said, it's not like, well, if Roald Dahl goes away, there's no kids' books to read. We're out. Sorry. We got to close up the kids' section and go home. If anything, there's so many more. I mean, there's so many more that my kids read. There's so many more kinds of stories, different voices, different authors, different perspectives that, you know, maybe the time of Roald Dahl has come and gone. And this is the last gasp of trying to make it a beloved children's book. And methinks the lady doth too much protest. I guess to quote the Shakespeare a little bit about this. An interesting case. I'd be curious to hear from the children's librarians out there and the teachers. I know we have them in the audience. Does this make you feel better? Does this make you feel worse? Have you heard about this from parents? Have your parent who's been on the fence? Did you even know? Do you even care? Or is this, you know, whatever that Vanessa are doing is a bit of a scholar's lament. And as all scholar's laments are, ultimately gets drowned out by market forces and cultural ideas about how these things happen. But a fascinating story. And you could imagine this not being the last case of something like this.
Yep.
I can't think of a sort of what the next one would be. But you could imagine a case where someone's like, okay, we can say hello to you fellow kids by updating to the best of our understanding what language we use. Yeah. I don't know, kind of a strange one. Ultimately, I'm okay. I shrug my shoulders a little bit. These are important stories to me. So I don't have that much skin in the game. But a lot of think pieces. The great think piece generator, I think, of so far of 2023, the Matilda situation. And probably not the last time we heard of it. Can you think of it? Who would be next for... It's not the opposite of canceling, but it's like sort of a moral insurance policy of getting baked into the books.
The closest comp I could think of is actually one that already happened and it got handled different, which is Sue. So it's just sadly I was like, who else is anti-Semitic?
Right.
And they basically we're just not going to publish them. Yeah, right. So like in theory, the Roald Dahl estate could have done that, but like clearly they weren't gonna.
Yeah.
For reasons, and so that is the, I don't know, that was the first one that came to mind. Ostensibly, I was like, okay, what's a really really giant kids book author that like we notably know, other than again stating like the obvious wizard school stuff,
right?
Yeah,
and the tack there was a little bit different. They're like, we're just gonna stop publishing the books that are problems. So like we have a rotting piece, we're gonna cut off the rotting piece of this apple, but the rest of the apple's fine. The Dahl estate's like,
I think what helps them
there are worms all through here. I don't even know.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think what helped them there is that the books that they got to eliminate, and this is probably me being experienced slash jaded again, but is that they were not their best sellers. Like, they just weren't. They were, like, kind of obscure.
It wasn't All the Places You'll Go.
It wasn't Cat in the Hat. So, like, it was very easy to be like, oh, we're going to scrap this book that none of you cared about until precisely this second. Again, wearing my jaded hat today, but that's what I'm coming at.
Well, you're not that, I mean, it's been several years since you were a frontline bookseller, but would people come in looking for Roald Dahl? Would they come in saying, do you have Matilda? Or like, what was the pulse of the buyer 4 or 5 years ago?
Yeah, now were people exactly buying it? Yes, it was tended to be people of a certain age, and I don't mean that to sound ageist. I just literally mean people who have like an attachment to the book. So that could mean anything from like a millennial up, right? So were they still being purchased? Yes. Did kids come in? No. Like they were looking for Wonder. They were looking for, what's that, Cats? Yeah. Anyway, they were looking for other stuff, right? Because they're like, they want to talk about the things
Cat
that their
Warriors?
Friends are. Cat Warriors, thank
Warrior
you.
Animals?
Yes, man, Cat that Warriors, was that was the series. Yeah.
My daughter has been threatening to go on the 40 volume plus Cat Warrior adventure, and I'm like, oh God.
I was absolutely the person selling five of those at a time to a mom who would come in and order five of them at a time, five of them at a time. So yeah. Anyway, yeah, point being that it was not a thing that kids were actively asking about, so there is that.
Right. Maybe let it go, parents. Let doll go. And this is an effort to... I wonder if they've seen something in the sales. 2020 is when they started thinking about this, it looks like. And that was a... As we all know, there was a spike in awareness about representation language, yeah. Especially about books, but everywhere else. And they got... I'm sure they got the ball rolling there. How much of it was, this is good for the world? And how much it was a... shoring up their moral saleability. Interesting to see. Anyway, podcast at bookriot.com if you've got a story or a take on Dahl. I don't hear him as those books talked about as much. Like the Matilda musical has kept that Absolutely. Story. I think Matilda's a beloved character.
Yep.
I don't know why we keep doing the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory thing. And maybe my radar's completely off, but I don't have a sense in the book lover's world of great affinity for that particular story.
Me neither.
So I don't know why we keep coming to that. Is it because Willy Wonka's a great character to play and you can get a movie made if Johnny Depp or Timothy Chalamet wants to do that? It seems very strange to me that we keep doing that particular one, but that's another situation. Speaking of messes...
Oh, God.
I know you don't... We don't want to talk about this. I'm not sure that we've had our head in the sand... As we're not ostriches doing that, but we're definitely looking for soft sand. Is there any soft sand around here?
Yeah, it's like, look, this looks nice.
When it comes to chat, GPT, and ebooks. So this particular story is not one I had anticipated. And I think I should get used to that phrase coming out of my mouth when it comes to this particular
yeah,
technology.
I think so.
There's been apparently a boom in AI written ebooks. You can ask the chatbot, and I haven't done this. Can you ask it to write a 20,000 short story with a couple of parameters? I haven't gotten that far into it, but apparently you either can, or you can in big chunks, or de facto you can use it to write a book like this. And that has a couple of different effects. One is that the independent or the smaller publications that have a slush pile. And for those of you who don't know what a slush pile means is you will accept unsolicited manuscripts for consideration for acquisition and publication. Mm-hmm. It tends to be smaller kinds of things like the New Yorker. Maybe there is technically a slush pile, but I don't think they're combing through it every week to decide what the short story is going to be in there. You know, correct me if I'm wrong. But the slush pile has a virtue, which is there is a place, if you don't have any connections in the book world, where you can submit and someone could theoretically see your work.
Yep.
But that viability and visibility only is possible at all if the size of the pile is somewhat manageable by the staff, right? And even to consider them, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure the submissions policies are different all over the place. I don't think everything in every slush pile is getting read. Maybe you'll give it a page.
Yeah.
Maybe the time it's constrained by the time you have that week, but at least there's somewhere to go. But if that slush pile is apparently has happened in some places like Clark's World, for example, that goes from 20 submissions a day to hundreds of submissions a day, like kind of in a couple month period, because people can churn out more crappy. And let's be honest, what we've seen so far is average, below average, but again, it's not gobbledygook, I guess I'll say.
No.
People are so impressed by ChatGPT. I'm not. I mean, it's fine, whatever. But I'm not like, would I have been proud to write that? No, I haven't seen one thing I would have been proud to write. So maybe it'll get there eventually. So that's a separate situation. But this is tough, right? Because on our level, I guess, Vanessa, from time to time, we open up submissions for new contributors.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that is a writing sample. Do you think tomorrow, if we open a call contributor, we'd see like an order of magnitude change in the number of submissions because of ChatGPT? Have you thought about this yet? We haven't talked. I know we've talked about some of this behind the scenes in terms of policy and, you know, we expect our writers to, you know, these are your words. And we kind of had to do some of that of late just to get out in front of it a little bit. But do you think that would happen? And then what would we do? I generally don't know how we'd figure this out if we got 500 when we expecting 50.
I thought about this a lot in the last like 48 hours specifically, because spoiler alert, we are getting ready to try to open up applications. So, a few things. Like, one, I have not attempted like a long, long form, but like several of the editors have attempted to make it at right, just sort of something shorter. And I will fully double down on the fact that nothing I have seen has been what I would call like impressive per se, where I'm like, wow. But does it also very much sound like Danica, for example, asked it to write something, and I can't remember what it is, but something specifically that she would have written about. And like, did it sound like Danica? No. Did it sound like something that a human conceivably could have written and that was average? Yes, absolutely. And like the differentiation factor, one, right? So that's problem number one. Two, the submissions, like it's hard, and we are a small company. There's not that many people reviewing these things. That is the case for a lot of, you know, submission-based publications. I don't know how we, that's a thing I'm going to have to think more about. Like, what are we going to do if we suddenly get flooded with all of this stuff, if it does meaningfully kind of sound human, for like, you know, I'm in a prickly place about how I feel about this for so many reasons.
Because it doesn't seem like the fear here is, and I read a good Substack by Lincoln Michael, who is kind of a literary person, has been around, has a couple books. His book called The Body Scout is pretty good. Came out a few weeks ago, or I think a couple years ago.
I think,
Anyway, he had a piece wrapping up some of this, but also talking explicitly about like the behind the scenes of how it's hard to know. And especially if you're trying to be a writer or a reader and you don't have, and I didn't have this kind of insight into it before I started doing this at all. And it took me a couple of years to understand it. How many manuscripts there are out there?
Yeah.
How many books there are that people have read, they want to publish, and it's really hard. And one of the reasons, I don't know that people have heard me rail against the gatekeepers on this show, and one of the reasons I haven't, at least the existence of gatekeepers, how those gates are kept are a different kind of story. But I know how many people are trying to get in those gates, how many manuscripts are trying to get those gates. It is hard to deal with. And the other truth of them is most of them are not worth your time to read.
Yeah.
They just aren't. They're just not worth your time to read. Rebecca and I were talking a couple of weeks ago that most of the books we read are pretty good and we really like them. Some of that is because we do a good job filtering.
Yep.
But some of that is because there are so many books out there that the ones that tend to get published by any kind of press you've heard of are pretty good. Because there's so many of them that taking just the top 1% means they're pretty good. And flooding the bottom decile. Well, it's not even decile anymore, but making there to be 10,000 more bad ones, because none of these would get published, right? No one's worried right now that these are going to crowd out a really interesting story written by a human, by hand, or whatever metaphor we're going to come up with. What it's doing right now is crowding out the time and attention that the gatekeepers had to try to find something special from someone special. And that's a bummer, right? I think, if anything, it's going to be harder. This actually hurts the kinds of voices that have a hard time getting heard anyway to get flooded. It just is. I hadn't thought about this just volume problem, because I'm not that concerned or even interested right now about the quality, because ChatGPT is not going to write Ulysses. It's not even going to write Matilda. No. It's just not. It's a mimic. It can mimic things pretty well, and mimic means you can probably be pretty average. Yep. So if you're if you depend on your livelihood for average writing, maybe you should be worried. But this situation is really difficult, and it makes the gatekeeping functions. And one thing Lincoln says is that probably it makes the network effect, that very thing that excludes people, gatekeepers are probably going to need to rely on that even more, right? I mean, you can understand that, but I don't know how you get around that. I think this is a very difficult problem if this becomes a thing. I'm not excited about this. And I wouldn't be excited if I'm a self-published author, right?
Nope.
Because I don't have the imprint of an imprint, right? I don't have all those things against me. And I wonder if the self-published world, which, you know, is algorithmically derived, there's a lot of tropes, it's a lot of genre, a lot of people that are reading category romance or category mystery thriller or mystery or something like this, especially on self-publishing platforms, individual readers are going to be the ones having to gatekeep instead of five results for, I don't know, period romance or
fill in the blank,
Elizabethan romance featuring a dog, right? There's instead of there being four, there's 50. What are you going to do? I have no idea.
Yeah, like in this Reuters piece that we were looking at, which is by Greg Benziger.
Yeah.
It talks about how, you know, in theory, there are several of these books that are flooding Amazon that are, they do list ChatGPT as an author. But there's also several people, or at least one or two, that are quoted, I think, in the piece as saying, like, no, I didn't feel the need to disclose that. Like, why? I did some zhuzhing to it. So just from like, I don't hate to be this person. I'm proud to be this person of like just getting into the whole art. It's actually a really great piece that Danica, our editor, wrote for the site that I think went up yesterday that kind of dives into like, well, what are the complexities around ChatGPT? And one of them dives into like, why do we want to tell stories? Why do we seek out stories? Like just the discussions of art sort of thing. When I'm looking at all these ChatGPT, honestly, the thing that really made me bristle is in that first couple paragraphs is that some dude says like, you know, I always thought of writing a book, and so I wanted to write a book, and now I have. I'm like, well, no, you didn't though. And no. Like, you literally didn't. Like, and he was like, yeah, now I feel like I can do this again. I'm like, but you didn't write the book. And like, if that is the whole reason that I look for stories and that I consume, you know, books, which obviously are an art to me, is for a specific purpose that I don't feel like ChatGPT can fill. So between my angst about that and then the difficulties that this now poses on actual, like you said, great stories, potentially making it into someone's hands, it just, I am so deeply not pleased about having to think about this, though I obviously will.
Well, and I think if in an early stage of a new technology, it's hard to know the trajectory. I'll just say that writ large. And sometimes the pluses and minuses don't become clear for sometimes. And sometimes it can be, if not self-correcting, at least some self-regulation. Because if people are spending time doing these ChatGPT things and end up not having a lot of success getting them placed, they'll stop doing them.
That's true.
Right. Yeah. So there could be kind of a gold rush here. Like, not everyone who went to San Francisco in 1849 turned into gold barons, right? True. In fact, vanishingly few did. So this could be a bit of a tragedy of the commons situation where this is available to everyone and everyone uses it, meaning that it's of no use to anyone from basically trying to misrepresent or get a AI-assisted or AI-generated story placed. I would hope pretty soon that there'll be some counter technologies available, right? Some can you detect? And we've seen this happening. There's been some upstart places saying, you know, run, much like you can run something through a plagiarism filter or it's like disappear online, could you run this through an AI detection filter and say, you know, with some confidence that this is an AI generated thing? And some of it because it could be too perfect, right? It could have no spelling errors or no punctuation errors or be completely grammatically correct, which most of us, including yours truly, who taught composition and grammar at a high level for a long time, still screw stuff up a lot, right?
Yeah.
So there could be some ways in which this is a day one or day zero kind of, oh my gosh, it's hard to extrapolate from initial conditions. But you can see a world in which this is a huge bummer. And I guess the other thing, from a book lover standpoint, I don't see a lot of upside, right? I can see in some fields there being a lot of upside. But in this one, I'm like, I'm struggling to find what version of this. I'm like, the books I'm reading are better.
Yeah.
I don't see it, Vanessa. Help me. Is there one? Is there some version of this where I'm like, maybe research people are doing? You know, I was just reading, I can't remember. I think Celeste Ng was tweeting about the research she was doing for her next book, which is always, it's kind of like teasing, but not teasing, but also just the life of the writer. And I wonder if some of that research is easier. Cause the other thing we know about search right now, just regular search on the web also kind of sucks.
Super.
So that's the only thing I can think about is maybe some of the research stuff gets more interesting. If you're doing historical fiction or really anything, we're trying to be responsible about representation in detail. But as a reader, I'm probably not going to notice that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I was going to say, as the reader, though, are you paying attention to that? What I don't know that I haven't spent, I thought about it, but I just don't have as much perspective on there, is there's any like accessibility upsides to this that I'm like not considering, and I'd like to just go ahead
and
say that.
That's a really good point.
We actually have someone, I think, who's actually writing a piece on the site about that from an informed place, being a disabled person herself, and so I'm obviously very open to like to that being a thing that I'm not considering in my crankiness. And if so, then of course I am pro that. But yeah, overall, like you said, I've shifted a little bit to potentially what you just said, giving more consideration to the fact that these are early days and that we might see like some course correction. But I'll be interested to see where it goes.
Yeah, let's do our second sponsor break and then wrap up with some other stuff.
Today's episode is brought to you by Unchipped, the most epic dystopian science fiction adventure series that you've probably never heard of. And bonus points because it's Finnish. And when's the last time you read a Finnish dystopian science fiction novel? Right, okay. So in this one, humanity is destroying itself as the cities burn, which sounds kind of familiar. It is the time of the great affliction. In this terrible world, a new hope arises. The Happiness Program, which is the creation of a Finnish pharmaceutical genius, Dr. Laura Solomon. With happiness, pills, mind mapping, and microchips, Dr. Solomon intends to build a new world for the worthy few, which sounds like a perfect plan and nothing could go wrong, right? Right. So this is a raw but fun dystopian sci-fi adventure with an unusual premise describing what happens when technology rules humanity. Either you're chipped living inside the AR society or you're left outside to barely survive. Make sure to check out Unchipped by Taya DeVere. And thanks again to Unchipped, the most epic dystopian science fiction adventure series that you probably never heard of, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Harper Horizon, publisher of Walk, Ride, Paddle. Walk, Ride, Paddle is a captivating memoir of Senator Tim Kaine's physical journey through the Virginia wilderness, but it is also a unique and ultimately optimistic perspective on these pivotal moments in history, offering inspiration, wisdom, and hope. With immediacy and honesty, Kaine pulls back the curtain to reveal his inner thoughts during such monumental times. And Kaine's storytelling gift and wise observations offer a fascinating glimpse into the mind of a seasoned politician and outdoor enthusiast. Walk, Ride, Paddle is available everywhere audiobooks are sold on April 9th. It is narrated and written by Tim Kaine, Virginia senator and former Democratic vice presidential candidate. It's a compelling account of one man's journey across hundreds of miles of Virginia wilderness and a moving testament to the optimistic spirit of America. So make sure to check out Walk, Ride, Paddle by Tim Kaine. And thanks again to Harper Horizon, publisher of Walk, Ride, Paddle, for sponsoring this episode.
So Kelly was going to co-pilot today, but she is without power, so luckily we have a deep bench we can pull on. And I asked her, is there anything you want to talk about specifically this week? And she's like, I really want to talk about Barnes & Noble's new membership plan, which I had seen, but I hadn't put on my radar. We haven't ever talked about this on the show, of loyalty programs from booksellers. And I remember as a teenager, when I was first like buying books on my own, the Raven bookstore in my beloved hometown of Lawrence, Kansas, had a punch card. And I think for every $75 I spent, I got $10 to spend. So that's what, a 12% kickback on that? Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, and this is, if you have any experience with this, Vanessa, as a seller or buyer or anything else, but this is actually as much of a call to the readers or the listeners right now. If you're part of a membership program, which do you use it? Does it matter at all? I did the Kindle Rewards bit a while ago. It doesn't seem to have mattered a bit. It doesn't matter a bit to my own book buying. So Barnes & Noble launches a new one. They've had one. This is a $40 annual membership service, and you get discount online, and you get some other stuff. They say they have 5.5 million people in their existing $25 membership program, and they think two-thirds of those people are going to move over to the $40. All right. Details, fine. I don't know if anyone cares. If you're a Barnes & Noble member and you're super excited about this, let me know, and I'll read your email or talk about your feedback. Do you care about this? Because like, we've talked about this internally with some other stuff, frequent flyer programs. I think you're in Alaska. You do the Alaska thing. You're flying back and forth to San Diego a bunch. Yep. You do Alaska. You get the points. You can use it. PRH famously has, infamously for us, has a reader rewards program to try to get you to buy from Penguin Warehouse, which is a whole other thing. I guess I'm surprised a little bit that this is not a bigger thing in book buying. Because Starbucks has one, it's like a big deal. Macy's, yeah. Nordstrom, like they're, Gap, Banana, and retailers, like they have their own credit cards, and I guess Barnes & Noble does too. I guess as much as anything is that book buying is so confederated that unless you're Barnes & Noble, maybe it doesn't matter, you know? And I don't even know, do most indie bookstores have, or do most indie bookstores don't? What's your experience been? What, as a seller and as a buyer with the idea of a membership plan?
I mean, my experience was all in San Diego and then obviously now in Portland. And I'd say for me, it was like probably like a 50-50, if I'm like remembering correctly, as far as like people that offered some kind of rewards. It tended to be more of what you just described, though, as like a... I have my stamp to Broadway Books now, but you buy so many books that I think you either get like another one, like a paperback for free, or like maybe $10. I forget what the reward is.
Yeah.
So like, do the reward programs exist? Yes. I wonder if, the reason why it isn't maybe bigger, it really just depends on the person's like book buying habits. I mean, right now you're trying to get, you know, you're competing with like, do people shop, you know, once upon a time, basically, Barnes & Noble really was the place that my parents were taking me to get books because we didn't live in a place that had an indie bookstore close. Mm-hmm. We didn't have Kindles, etc. So it was pretty much like you were going to like the Walden Books, the B. Daltons, or the Barnes & Noble of the world.
Yeah.
And I was absolutely a person who had memberships once I was in like in college or high school because I was a power book purchaser and what have you. But then now there's just so many different places where you can buy books. I don't know that... I guess it just depends where people's loyalty is. Like, I'm wondering too, what is so enticing? And maybe I didn't read this piece carefully enough, but like, why it's like, do you get a much better perk for it to be the $40 versus the $25? I know they offer like a lower
tier. The old one was only good at physical stores.
Oh, that's right.
And the new one
is
good online.
Okay.
So that is a potentially significant change for people that buy a lot of their books online from Barnes & Noble. And Barnes & Noble hasn't cared, or I don't know, cared is the wrong word. Their online commerce situation has not been awesome. And they focused on bricks and mortar. That's where their bread and butter is. I'm now mixing all of my metaphors, but you hear what I'm saying. They're putting their butter on their bricks is what they've been doing over the last couple of years. And I wonder if this is an attempt to engage with a different kind of consumer, right? I can only imagine that the wealthier, more urban buyer wants to have this stuff delivered. I like to go to the bookstore. Sometimes I just want to have it delivered, and those are two different book buying instances for me.
Yep.
They're functionally different. So I could imagine that by getting, they want to loop those people in. And you know, this also occurred to me. I go to a Barnes & Noble every now and again. There's several around Portland in malls and other places, and the kids like to go, and it's a good family 45-minute time.
Yep.
And I was talking on the podcast recently about one of the new format ones out west of town. Have you been out to that one out in Hillsborough? I'm not sure how often you get west, but there's one of the newer format Barnes & Nobles out
there. No, I haven't been to that one.
It's nice. It's a good browsing experience.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. But you know what I didn't think about then, and I didn't have my eyes out for? One of the things that Barnes & Noble did, famously memorialized in You've Got Mail, which it's the 25th anniversary of You've Got Mail this year, by the way. We got to do something about that. That's a different conversation altogether. Discounting. That was the hook. 40% off bestsellers, 30% off hardcovers. Does Barnes & Noble discount as much as they used to? I feel like maybe they don't. Because if that's the hook, you don't need a membership thing.
Correct. Yeah, that's the book industry in general being a thing that operates on such thin margins has always been really interesting to me when you get into discussions of discounts, because like, frankly, I think that's probably why more indies don't offer it, because unless you are established and have like a really robust community of people that are buying from you all the time, it's hard to offer discounts on stuff that you're already like squeaking by. Someone like a Barnes & Noble could possibly do that. And then, I will say I did recently go into one in San Diego, and I remember thinking that, when I was younger, the reason I bought so many books from them, because I was absolutely balling on a budget, is that I would go to those, like, racks.
I can get more books per allowance money, Vanessa.
Exactly.
Yes, so many.
And I don't think I've seen as much of that. Maybe it's because I just don't go in as often. Maybe I miss the tables. I feel like the last thing I saw way more tables about TikTok books than I did about, like, here's the really pricey, slashy stuff.
Yeah.
So,
You know, it's true. We've talked about this to some degree, and I don't think there's a lot of data around it. You'd have to get someone at Amazon or one of the big publishers, frankly, to talk to you about. It just doesn't feel like it. So we're going to do, this is a double plug. This is a double-edged sword. I'm mixing it again. I have some questions for you by Rebecca Mackay as our new Patreon book club pick.
Ooh.
We're going to do that episode, record it next week. Right. And so there was a time, so right now on Amazon, this is the easiest place to go. $24 hardcover, discounted down from 28. So that's a 14% discount. There was a day, I feel like, a few years ago, that would have been a 30% discount. This is a big literary commercial crossover book from, is this Doubleday? Let me just see. I think it's Doubleday.
I can't.
God. All right. There's so many blurbs.
I know. That's why I'm like.
I don't know. It looks like maybe it's blurb. Jeez, this used to be so much better. What a disaster. Anyway, secondary. Oh, Viking. Okay. So it's in the Penguin group, not the Knopf group at Penguin Random House. No one cares, but I do. So it's a big, it's Viking's a big commercial imprint. I wouldn't be surprised if this gets picked for Reese's Book Club or some other pieces that haven't already, haven't really followed it. 14% discount. It used to be 30. It would have been 30 in the old days.
Yep, sure would have.
And I guess it would have. And so, and I think probably if I went to Barnes & Noble, it would be similar. It seems like 10 to 15% for all but the top, like the very, very, very big loss leaders. Like I'm just going to type in Lessons in Chemistry right now because that's that book continues to sell. That's crossed over. No, it has.
Specifically on Barnes & Noble, too. Okay. Yeah.
Is that true? Yeah. Well, they did. That's right. That was their book of the year.
Yeah.
So Lessons in Chemistry, right now, number one best-selling hardcover on Amazon last week.
Wow.
This is almost a year old now. The sticker price, $29. The buy new price on Amazon, $18.26. So that's still 37%.
That's still, okay.
But that's the exception rather than the rule. It used to be that every single thing that came out on hardcover on Amazon, you could get at a 30 to 40% discount.
Yeah.
And I wonder, as that has been pulled back, if that's an untold story or an unacknowledged element of indies having resilience, of Barnes & Noble coming back, because maybe some of the pricing pressure isn't there anymore. It's not quite as bad as it used to be. Is that possible?
It's very possible.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there we go. Anything else? I don't know. Was membership? I guess the whole like pricing and discounting and membership about books is so fascinating.
Because
one of the reasons that a Gap or an Alaska Airlines or a Starbucks can do stuff differently is they're not selling exactly the same goods, right? That's the
Correct.
Problem with books. That lessons in chemistry is a commodity you can buy in like four or five different places.
Yep.
Rather than you want to buy my product. It's a little bit different.
Fly on my airline, get my coffee. Yeah, exactly.
That's right. The same kind of thing. Okay. Last thing, a bit of an announcement. We've got a new thing that Book Riot's doing. Fortuitous, actually, that one of the reasons that you're on this today is it's a newsletter that has a subscription element. Well, why don't you tell people what it is? And then I'll come in with my stupid small contribution.
So we are launching a cool new newsletter over on Substack. It's called The Deep Dive. The Deep Dive is going to feature basically just more behind the scenes stuff. It's going to have like really more in-depth stories, like kind of deep takes, useful advice, stuff that's, as we have, you know, branded it, experts in the world of books and reading. It'll be like much more juicy, long form content coming from people like the editors, for example, and Jeff. Jeff famously has, when he's doing one of our first pieces,
posted
Rebecca. We've got two really great ones in there. There is going to be both a paid tier and a free tier. So if you get the free tier, you will get once a month a roundup of sort of bookish recommendations and or bookish goods that are recommended to you again by like Book Riot peeps. And then if you do the deep dive, you're going to be getting that particular subscription. So you'll be getting, like again, like a long, meaty newsletter on topics of our choice that we're just really jazzed to do. And this is where the fun element comes in for us, because it's given us some space to both go off on some deep ends, just wax on for a bit about a thing we're really interested in some cases really wanted to research, and bringing that for people that are wanting to kind of join us in the deep end, as I have said a few times in the copy for said newsletter. I apologize in advance for all of the puns that went into this making. But yeah, really jazzed about it. I'm one of the creators, obviously, behind this, as is Jeff. And yeah, we're excited to bring this to the people.
So I'll put a link in the show notes where you can go find it. I don't know if the piece I did is one of the free ones, one of the paid ones. I'm not actually sure. I'll talk about it just for a minute. So I wrote 2,200 words. Sharifa edited me, so I don't know what she cut it down to. I think she took out a little, you know, maybe cleaned me up a little bit. So somewhere around that, Sharifa edited me for this. I guess there's another thing to say is like you and I and Sharifa and Rebecca, we don't write for the site anymore. We do the pods or some of the behind the scenes stuff. And one of the reasons we got excited about this is a different value proposition for us to go deep on something.
Yeah.
A 2,000 word feature on BR anymore is not something we do a whole lot of. It's a longer time, but really spotlighting it and giving ourselves a chance to wallow in one. So my piece is why the Colleen Hoover phenomenon is the weirdest bookish phenomenon of of all time. For those of you who are on the Patreon, you know that Rebecca and I picked it as one of the 10 weirdest bookish phenomenons of our reading lives. And that was kind of the diving board. But I'm going to extend the pool metaphors. You'll do the puns, I'll do the metaphors.
Great.
Because I didn't really capture how strange it was in that particular moment. And this, I think, I don't know, I have like 5 or 6 bullet points talking about how it's strange. And none of them, frankly, for those of you listening to Patreon, are that I didn't care for it. I think it's so outside, or it being, I only read It Ends With Us.
It Ends With Us,
maybe, yeah. The other ones are wildly different. That has not been my, that's not the information I've gotten from the larger reading world. But I had a really fun time writing this. I'll give you, Rebecca read it, and she said her favorite sentence when I said, Colleen Hoover is fast and furious for the heart and sometimes groin. So that's your tease about what I wrote about Colleen Hoover.
Jeff, you're really selling it to me right now.
Go check that out. That's what I'm saying. I know. You and Jen are fast and furious people.
Yes, we are. But anyway, that's neither here.
Are you excited for Fast X? Are you mourning? Because is this the last? It sounds like Vin Diesel's giving me this is the end of the line vibes when I'm watching the trailer.
Yes,
for Fast
if there is a way that I can make this bookish and put this in the deep dive, you best believe you're sweet. You know what? That like, it's going to happen because this is like such a large part of who I am. It is such a, like an anomaly for me and the things I'm interested in. But yes, I am excited / mourning that this will, in theory, it's supposed to be the last one. So we'll see how that goes.
Yeah. Anyway, not to make this about the Fast and Furious, but I had a lot of fun. I tried to be both critical and entertaining at the same time and play around. And so go check that out if you're interested at all in different kinds of longer form introspection, just spection at all. Introspection, circumspection, all those
all
kinds
the
of things. That's the deep dive, and I'll be plugging it more as we go on. And you know what, Vanessa? That's our time today. We're done.
We did it. We did.
Flies by. Do you want to plug anything you've read recently that you really liked? Usually Rebecca and I spend a minute, but is there anything on the tip of your tongue that you're like, this was great?
Yeah, I actually just finished reading Stoneblind by Natalie Haynes, which Natalie Haynes is the author of 1,000 Ships, which is one of the ones that was shortlisted for the Women's Prize, I think, in like 2020. She's a classicist and like comedian and a podcast host all about the classics, so like she just does a great job with this stuff. But this one's written to retell Medusa's story, and it's very feminist, and I highly recommend it on audio because she reads it, which, you know, being like a performer herself, she lends a really great attitude to the performance, and it paints every single one of the gods and goddesses as the most petulant, petty, like it's just such a strong voice. Like it was really funny, like almost modern in its like application in the way that some of these characters play out, but with this like story of Medusa and how women have, especially in the classics, like so often paid the price for like the decisions of men. So yeah, I'm really, really fascinated with that one. It's one of my favorites of the year.
I am to the point where I do need a recommendation like that to pick up a feminist retelling of Greek mythology. Not that I haven't liked them, but just there's so many now.
Are you in general?
Is this a genre jam for you, or is this unusual for you to be reading?
It should just be tattooed on me at some point. This is definitely like a thing that I pick up pretty automatically, and it's stood out as one of like the cooler ones to me lately. Just because again, the voice is
a little bit different. Deep dive coming on.
Oh, yeah,
I think
it's
you may need to rank the best modern feminist retelling. Is that happening? Okay, good.
Yeah,
I would read that, and I will read that when it comes out, because there's so many now, and some of them, they tend to all seem pretty good. Like the floor of quality for these seems pretty good. Am I wrong about that?
No, like I read so much of it, and I got to tell you, like there's only been like 2 in the last couple years that I've read that really I'm like, okay, I got to take and lift that. But like, yeah, I've read like Claire North, it's out here. Jennifer Saint did a really great one. Natalie Haynes. And that's just the Greco-Roman stuff. Like I read across lots of different.
Right. Like lots of mythologies.
Garcia. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah.
Oh, great. Great, great book.
All right.
Highly recommend it.
I look forward to that. A coming deep dive. Vanessa is putting on sunscreen. She's getting ready to do the deep. She's getting the swimsuit on. She's getting a big hat out. She's getting ready to get out on the pool for a deep dive. I'm looking forward to that. Vanessa, thank you so much. A pleasure to have you as always.
Thank you so much.
For the listeners out there, bookriot.com/listen. Shoot us an email, podcast@bookriot.com. Check out the Patreon, patreon.com/thebookriotpodcast. The most recent one was a Jeff bad weird idea that I think people actually enjoyed. So it's a giveaway. Rebecca and I are doing a giveaway, but you have to listen to the Patreon to figure out what the story is with that. But we had a good time with that. Vanessa, we'll talk to you sometime, hopefully not as long next time. Maybe if we're going to be snowed in, we're just going to start podcasting every
day. That's all we're going to do. Stay tuned.
Yeah. I station Diaz. All right, Vanessa, we'll talk to you later.
Thanks so much.